Everest just came in by chance. Climbing or hiking or camping was never in my radar. And I think that pretty much resonates with any other African child. Adventure for most of us is a thing that you don't grow knowing. There will be times when outside forces or influences will determine the result of what you do. It's a question of, do you adapt to that and be flexible enough to work with those forces? So there's a lot that I had to learn, and which became a shift which happened immediately, which then got me to the top.
My name is Sarah Kumalo, a businesswoman, a mother, and an award-winning mountaineer. I know what it feels like when the ground shakes beneath you. 3 times, Mount Everest sent me back down through avalanche, earthquake, and injury. 3 times, the world told me to quit. I kept going, and on the 4th attempt, I stood on the summit. Most would call the earlier attempts failure, but I learned something different. The shift is not the disruption. The shift is the lesson. It's not the fall that defines you, but the rise. Because true failure only happens when you stop taking the next step. In When Shift Happens, we explore the moments that break us and how they build us. Take a breath. The air is thin up here, and the views are worth it. Welcome to the summit journey. Let's go higher. Welcome to When Shift Happens. Some people are born into a world that tells them that this is possible and this is impossible. Others must rewrite possibility with their own steps. My guest today, Sibusiso Vilane, comes from a village of Shongwe, a place where Everest was not a dream, not even a story, not even a concept. And yet, this man stood on the roof of the world not once, but twice. His shift began with an opportunity that knocked on his door that was never something he had ever imagined. A stranger called John, that we have come to know, told him that he could climb Everest. And instead of rejecting the unfamiliarity of it all, Sibusiso chose courageously to say yes. That yes became the beginning of a journey that would make him the first black man to step on the roof of Africa, proving that greatness is not interested in who you are, where you come from, but it can be created by anybody. The world is limitless. That belief in your mind made it possible for Sibusiso to step on top of the world, from heading cattle in rural Mpumalanga to raising the South African flag above the clouds. He made history, a testament to a profound truth of what is possible. Possibility expands the moment you believe that you belong where you are, that possibilities belong to you. Today, we climb into the mind of a pioneer, a man that turned an unlikely beginning into a continental legacy. That's what it is. If Sibusiso could transform the impossible into the new norm, what limitations are you still holding on to? Sibusiso, welcome to the True Ascent.
Well, thank you very, very much indeed for having me. I appreciate the time and the opportunity.
I love it. So, beyond what I've said, who is Mr. Vilane?
It is a very hard one to articulate that, because I don't think I know who I am. I don't know who I am. But yes, I am that child who grew up in the lowveld and the bushveld, where the first 10 years of his life were tough, they were rough. I look back and look at the life of myself and my sister, who was younger than me. I believe that if people had seen me and my sister at those ages, they would have probably pitied us, because we looked poor, we had no clothes to wear, we were running around barefooted, we were not at school when we should have been at school. So that is the Sibusiso that I am, because I think all of us are shaped by mostly the backgrounds we come from. Then we may change things around us when we start flipping the script and deciding what else we want to do. But that background molds you, and it just makes you who you are. So I am that child who grew up in rural South Africa and later to Eswatini, who had no home, who had no clothes, no food, and then decided one day that I was going to change all of that.
Wow. So when you look back at that child with your sister running around in the village, heading cattle at some point, what seeds of courage or discipline were already present long before Everest became a reality?
They come in many folds. First, it starts with me looking at people around us where we were, looking at families that had children who were well looked after, who went to school, who celebrated Christmas when we couldn't. And it makes you ask the question, but why am I different from them? And then that tells you it's because you're maybe the person that should have been responsible for such mm-hmm. things, he has never taken the responsibility. In my case, it was my dad, because my mother was trying, because she was not educated or anything. You could see that she was making the effort. But anyway, it was when you look around you and realize that life is better in that way. So you want to model other people at that mm-hmm. very young age. Then it sort of makes you pause a little bit, because you are small and you are younger. You don't know how to go about it. So you are hoping to grow. But my mother comes in to me. She says one day, every time she would say this to me, one day you will grow up and you will be a man. You will go, I will take you to a place, to a local chief where we will look for a piece of land where we will build our own house. And that becomes this sort of discipline that she instills in me, that young as you are capable, but you have to wait to the edge that to be able to do this for us. And anyway, she empowered me in a way that at that point I never thought. She was that instilling in me it is your responsibility. It is yours to change this current circumstance and situation. So for me, it was just around that. My mother played that pivotal role to make me believe I can, and made me believe that I have a responsibility, not just a responsibility for us, but a responsibility for myself. Mm. And that encouragement was the one that made my life to sort of look at my life very differently, because as much as we thought we're poor, I didn't see us poor. I just saw us having the ability to change all of that. And I believe that one day I will be able to do that. But that means then, obviously, from that time, I sort of channeled all my energies towards one thing. You will grow up, go to school if you do, but much more, one day you will build a house for your sister and your mother.
Yeah, I love that. So it wasn't about Everest. It was about getting out of the situation that you're in by any means possible.
Everest for me was never even anywhere in my line of thinking. And I think that pretty much resonates with any other African child. Adventure for most of us is a thing that you don't grow knowing. And I never had gone to a holiday with my parents, be it my mother and my dad. And we had never shared a holiday together. And adventure, therefore, was never anywhere near our vocabulary and understanding of things. But you realize then that in a way or the other in your life, if you are meant to do anything, it will come to you unknowingly so. So no, mountain climbing, regardless, never think Everest. Climbing or hiking or camping was never in my radar. Even when I started working in a nature reserve where you would think this is the resource, because people will walk into the reserve going to do hikes somewhere overnight, I never even asked why they were doing it, because it was like, why? Why would you want to do that? You've got your main focus, and that's that work and make a living that you want your life to be. And that was that. So Everest just came in I wouldn't say by chance, but if you look at it, it was by chance.
Yeah, interesting. I actually laugh because somebody once said to me, why hike? I grew up walking kilometers to school. I'm out of that. I need to drive everywhere. So I can relate to that, absolutely. So the Everest journey began with John, who, thank you, I met before he left us and through you. And someone seeing potential before you could see it in yourself. Take us back to that moment where John said, Ipsbusiso, you can climb Everest. And what made you say yes?
So I love this story of John and myself eventually climbing Everest. But how I met John, because that is the biggest puzzle. Mm-hmm. I was working at reception area in the nature reserve and having not guided anyone on the hikes, but I knew the hikes because we cleared the hikes and we looked after them. So I knew the map, and mm-hmm. we told people, oh, you can go here, you can park your car here. This is walkable. This is not. So John, anyway, walks in the morning. I'd started at about 6 a.m. because I was the one who opened the office. And I sign him in. We don't talk much. He just enters just like any other guest. He signs and then he goes. He doesn't say where he was going. After, in the afternoon, I'd finished off work. It's one of those bizarre Saturdays where you knock off, you hand over to your work colleague, but you don't feel like you want to rush down to the ranger's camp. You just hang around. And as I was hanging around with my colleague, John walks in, and there's this little feeling that just listen, and even though don't engage. So I step away and I listen to him making a comment, which went like, my friend is talking to my colleague. My friend, this is such a beautiful place. I did a walk today, but I was a bit uncomfortable because it is so big and so vast. I thought if one get lost here, I would not possibly be found. All I want to know is, are there any groups of hikers who I can join on a weekend? And my work colleague correctly said, I'm sorry. So people that come and walk here, they come with their own groups of friends. He was saying, I cannot possibly point you to a hiking club or anything. So John poses the next question, which now forces my heart to pound, because he says, do you know any local fellow here in the neighborhood that I can ask, because I'd love to walk here? Then I stood up and I introduced myself to him and I said, if you are interested, honestly interested in doing a walk here, I'm one of the rangers and I know the place and the area very well and the trail, so I'd be happy to accompany you on a Saturday when I'm off duty. And for me, that is the sort of moment that shifted the whole thing to getting me to have done what I've done, because I could have played it in two ways. I could have said, I've knocked off, I'm not interested, and then I walk away. I wouldn't be talking to you today. But I decided to have the interest and listen. And when I listened again, I said, I will offer him my time. And if John was alive, he would tell you exactly the same thing. He went on to support some of my ambitions because I offered my time without even knowing who he was, and that was profound. So anyway, so we agree that on this particular Saturday, we're going to do this walk, and I decided to take him on a trail I knew very well, which was beautiful in my case. And then obviously I'm acting lead. I wasn't guiding up until I walked with him. I just knew the trail. So we walk and I'm guiding him, telling him to be safe, and we crisscross a river many times. Then we get to this beautiful waterfall, and we'd come from the bottom of the river. So he couldn't see the top part of the waterfall. So this is where the story goes, because when we get there, he looks up, he said, is it possible for anyone to climb to the top of the waterfall and have a view from it? I said, yes. But there was a little pool. People will laugh that probably many years ago they had me claiming that I can't swim. Because I said to him, we can possibly climb if we don't swim, because you could either swim and then start scrambling on the rock. I said, no, that we don't do because I can't swim. So I said, if you allow me to help you on the side, I certainly will. And that is what I did. So again, I led him up and we scrambled on this, not really knowing anything. And I get to the top of the waterfall. John has the view that he wanted to see. And then before we climbed down, he says, Sibu, hey, it's amazing because I've been watching you today and you climb with such ease and you don't show any fear. It just sort of makes me feel that it is a talent to you, but much more shows that there are many other Africans who have got the same ability as you are. But it begs the question why an African has never attempted Everest in almost 40 years since Hillary climbed Everest. And now this is the biggest moment, because he says Everest. I'm like, what is that? It's a mountain where? I know in Africa we have Kilimanjaro, but I don't know this Everest. What is he talking about? So I had to try and think, and I couldn't place Everest anywhere. So I said to him, are you talking about a mountain which is overseas? He says, yes, it is in this vast mountain range called the Himalayas in Asia. Mm-hmm. Then he says, the Everest I'm talking about is the highest of them all, covered in snow. And I'm 26 years old. I've never seen snow in my life. So you can imagine the blankness when he talks about this. And then he says to me, well, people do go there, but it is dangerous and some people die. Somehow, you can imagine you talking about this and you're thinking, but then still, why do people do it? So anyway, I say to him, look, I do not think, that was the comment I made, I don't think it would be impossible for us to climb Everest. However, I believe that we cannot afford to pay to go overseas to climb a mountain. Again, I was sort of playing this tape. You go, you don't have the money. You go to a grandmother and who's driving to put food on the table. You say, "Grandma, can I please have some money?" And grandma is getting excited, thinking you've got a scholarship or you've got a job overseas or anything. And you say, "No, no, grandma, I'm going to climb a mountain." And I realized that was going to be the shortest conversation you ever have with your grandmother. You're going to do what? And she will ask you all sorts of questions. So I thought at that moment that you've defeated this man, you've answered yourself, and he will never pose another question. John says something that will change the course of my life forever, because he made me realize, before I get to that point, is he says, "Yes, I agree, Sibusiso, it is expensive. However, people that tends or gets to do these things, they get sponsorship." So he says, "Do you say, if you had the resources to climb Everest, meaning if you had the money, because you say it's a matter of affordability, if you could afford it, would you do it?" For me, that was the big question, because he made me realize that sometimes we hide behind the resources being the finances. That's okay. Yes, you've got the backup. You've got to have the backup in monetary terms, but that is not the top. The top is, do you have the desire? Do you have the will? Do you really want to do it? Because I've been to mountains anyway, to cut that long story short, where people that are well off, they've got the money and something happens and then they're the first ones to leave the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is not about the money. You can have the money, but it cannot motivate you to stay the course and reach the top. It's the person that have the strongest will, which is personal. So that was what was asking me. But somehow, second to that, the reason. Because when he asked that question, I said, he says, "If you have the resources to do it, would you do it?" And then the immediate question for me, but why would I do it? I needed to find a very compelling reason. And it came very quick. Mm. Do it for Africa. So that answers the question, why saying yes to him? I said, "I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't even think we will afford it. But if I get the chance to do it, I want to do it for Africa. Because I want to prove to myself, to South Africans and Africans and the world, that Africans can achieve as great heights, as greatness, just like anybody. And I want to put myself in that role to play practically and make every African believe that they can." So my reason came from that. I couldn't have been informed by any other decision to say yes other than wanting to do it for Africa, because it said to me, an African has never attempted it.
Amazing. The power of yes. You know, let's figure out how we'll do it. But yes, we can. Reminds me of Obama, actually. Yes, we can. So before Everest, which you say you had no idea even existed while you were in the village, you had never seen the mountain of that scale. I mean, the Drakensberg is nothing compared to Everest. In fact, I was chatting to Dr. Nima, one of the Sherpas, who was telling me that it doesn't sound like you have any mountains in South Africa. You have hills. I'm like, no, there are mountains. And we had such a big argument because I was defending the Drakensberg. So for them, they define it as hills. What mental, physical, and spiritual preparation allowed you to step into something so unfamiliar to an African child?
Yeah. So when after that conversation with John, then he says to me, "I don't know how people go about it, but I'll try. I'll try just to find out who organizes these expeditions." So he sort of mentioned it as a sort of a wild idea that might happen, that might not happen. So I don't really fully buy into it. Mm. But anyway, in 1999, before he left Southern Africa, he heard that one of his friends was going to climb Kilimanjaro with his son. And he kindly said to me, "I'm not interested because I did it years ago, but if you want to do it, I'd be happy to sponsor you." Then I go and climb Kilimanjaro and I see a mountain. Obviously, in my mind, it didn't really look any different from the Drakensberg or anything else. Mm. It's a little bit taller, but it's like that. So when I said to John, "Yes, I'll do it," I'd never seen a picture of Everest. I'd never read an article about it, not even watched a movie about Everest. I was blank. But the physical and mental preparation that I needed to make came when I had a preliminary sort of expedition to the Himalayas, where the company that was going to lead the expedition, organize the expedition, wanted me to be climbing something where they are looking at me, assessing my ability. And we went to the Everest Valley, and they call it the Khumbu Climber because part of it were in the Khumbu Valley. And we climbed, we attempted two mountains. One was about just under 6,000 meters, a little bit lower than Kilimanjaro, and then Island Peak, which is about 6,000 meters. Then we went down to Lobucha East. In all of these mountains then that we were attempting, I was seeing things happening, and people from my group as well getting high altitude sickness and being evacuated, because when I was told that there's a thing called high altitude sickness, I'm like, how does that work? How do you get sick of high altitude? I had no idea. Then when I saw it in reality, seeing how scary and deadly it was, then I started not being terrified. I started realizing that this is what it is. So if you get sick, this is what happens. And then on Island Peak, we were successful. We summited. We come down, then we're going up to Lobucha East on summit morning. We start. One said, really, it was one of the guys in my team when we started in the morning. Again, he was just coughing beyond redemption anyway, couldn't recover from that. And then again, you realize, oh, people can get stopped by just being sick and their body doesn't allow them. This is strange, because I didn't know about it. Anyway, those of us that went, we were going up this ridge on Lobucha East, and it was one of those days, years, where it was just completely covered in snow, and the conditions were really quite technical and tough and dangerous. Three people were coming from the summit, because we'd been going for a long time. It was about probably 9, 10 a.m. because, you know, you start at dawn. And they're coming down, and I stop because I was said in the front was fixing an ice screw to make sure that we are safe on the rope. So I was waiting. I see these people coming down, and then one of them came past me because they were short roped. Then I greeted him, tried to speak to him, but it didn't seem to understand what I was saying. Then I said, okay, thank you. And then he went past me. I did not see that happen, but my teammates say that they saw him unclip, and he took one or two steps and then just fell over. Ooh. And then the next call was, Sibu, see, so the guy that has just passed you, did you see that he's fallen on the side? When I looked on the side, because it was a cliff, a snow cliff, and he'd fallen down that cliff. And then LP Shepherd, who was our third, when I told him, he says, oh, this is too bad, because where he has fallen, no one will be able to retrieve him. And that was that. So because my teammates, those who were behind me, saw the thing happening, they were shocked, terrified. And then we called that off. That was the reality that I had to contend with mentally, and understanding that what I'm about to embark on when I go to Everest, I might die, I might get an accident, I might not make it home alive. And these things do happen for real, because sometimes you read about them, we think, ah, maybe. Then for me, that was that. So the mental growth and spiritual growth was, I had to humble myself and say, I leave it into the Almighty that I'll be safe. And secondly, I'm going to learn as I go. Be humble about it. Learn as you go, because you don't know nothing. Play your game at best possible. If anything happens, then it's okay. But you should pay attention, understanding that these things do happen. So I had to read a lot now, because I'd never read. So I read a lot, and I was very lucky to get two books. One is a very famous or popular book, known, I'm sure you have a copy, Into Thin Air by John Krakauer. And then Rebecca Stevens, the UK or the British first woman climber to do it in 1996 or 93, somewhere there. I was reading, I read John Krakauer's one before I went to Everest now. When I went for that preliminary, I was reading it, and it sort of painted, I wouldn't say a very good picture. It painted a very agonizingly tough picture for me to decide, do you want to do this? It asked me the question, reading what you are reading, do you really want to go? Mm. But then the purpose of going was very overpowering. It was bigger than what I was reading. So I said, yes. In spite of what I'm reading, I'm going to do this for my continent. Then Rebecca Stevens' one was when I was climbing the mountain, and we had three attempts in the season. First two were off, they failed. It was on the second attempt where I was sitting at camp two, not knowing whether we were going to go or we were just going to go home. At the red where they were stuck at camp three and hanging on for dear life in a blizzard, in a storm. And eventually they recover from that and they go and she saw me. So I said, if she could go through that, so can I. And that I had to put myself into that. So that was my sort of my mental preparation, because I had no clue. Like, I had no reference as to where to sort of train myself to be mentally tough and mentally prepared. It was just reading those two books. And then the biggest thing for me was just the reason why I was there. I wasn't going to walk down without a summit, not because of haphazardly doing so, but the motivation was such that anything, if given the opportunity and the weather being on my side, I'm going to find my way to the summit.
Yeah.
I was mentally prepared to even crawl on all fours. I said, even if it calls me crawling on all fours, I was going to go. I had no doubt that I was well prepared, but mentally. Physical training, I never did anything. I never climbed anywhere. I couldn't, because we couldn't afford to send me anywhere else to go train and everything. And like, I want to believe, if you don't have the resource, I didn't really sort of frustrate myself about that. I came back and recognized that my strength is in my physical ability, and that physical ability comes from my social hobby, which is running. So I came back and I ran. I remember one of the articles went like, training for Everest among lions, because I would run in the nature reserve where I was working, in the game reserve where I was working, driving, being almost being chased by lions and elephants and everything. But I knew then, once I was very convinced that physically I'm well prepared, I was going to be okay. And that is what I went, I sort of took, and it carried me throughout. In the agony of the technical and the steepness and the hardship, I was physically ready to take on the challenge.
It's an amazing story, Swissy. So you've told me some of these, but as I'm looking at you, those were not the days of social media. Those were the days where, you know, we waited for you to come down the mountain before we could hear the stories. So it wasn't about, you know, I want to tell people, but you seem to have had the conviction, which is quite humbling. What was going through your mind when your counterparts, maybe, you know, expedition team members, saw you as an African? First of all, did they welcome you? Did you feel confident to be part of the team, or did you feel alienated? And what was going through your mind when you saw that you were the only one of your kind within those environments? Was it inspiring? Was it scary?
Yes, it's a very interesting one, that as well, because at first you had the feeling, that's me thinking, you had the feeling that, you know what, this is a sport that is not for us. And therefore, I'm trying to do this thing that none of my people, race, have done. And the biggest question, it started when I was still at home, because I was talking to friends and they would say, no, we aren't, you think that we'll do it, and so-and-so has failed, and you've never climbed any other big mountain or anything. So from when you leave your house, you already have got this pressure to really prove everyone wrong. And so I always mention this when I share the story with people, to say, 2003, I team up with 11 other climbers, two of which were the expedition leaders. And we were quite diverse in experiences. Some of them had a number of 8,000, because for them, it was a change that they wanted. This is something they wanted to do when they were young and they were climbing other mountains to get to know their bodies. I never had all of that. So vast experiences, different experiences. We were seven different nationalities, again, cultures and culture clash and such. So you come into this group and you know for sure that you are inferior in experience and race. And the question comes, as you mentioned, that some people that from overseas look at us and say, you're a mountaineer, but Africa, there are no mountains in Africa. So it's one of those things that in your mind they play. But how lucky or fortunate I was that my team wasn't like that. But as I start walking in towards base camp, I meet a person who was walking the different direction. But from a distance, I can see that he's smiling, and I'm looking at him like, I don't know him. And he gets to me, he greets me with this cheerfulness, and he says, where are you from? I'm from Africa, the country South Africa. He says, but why are you here? Not necessarily questioning it, but asking me, wanting to know. So I said, I'm here because I want to climb Everest. He says, how delightful I am to meet a black person, because I never met a black person. I've been coming here for the past 10 years. You are the first person I meet. But much more, the fact that you are here to climb Everest, that warms my heart to hear that, and I wish you well. Then I realized, okay, this is okay. this is okay. You go and prove to anyone that it can be done. If there are people that really wants to embrace you and see you do this stuff, then go for it. So I met my team. We'd never met anywhere else. And I can see that they love me. They like me. And they don't even ask me, what have you climbed before? They were so accommodating, such that it made me feel like I was them. And as such, it helped because I was like them made me to be able to stay at the back, just watch what they're doing and allow them to coach me and guide me through that. But if that feeling wasn't there, I think I would have struggled. I don't even think I would have lasted that long. But they made it such that it was comfortable. Coming back to the Sherpa village, Sherpa people as well, talking of race and stuff. It starts when I land in Lukla, this little place where you start. And the kids will just gather around in groups from a distance, though they're chattering things and I cannot hear what they're saying. They're giggling and everything. But as soon as I took a step towards them, they will all disperse, running away because we don't know what this animal is. If they called it an animal or something, is a human, is like us or something. But I could see the curiosity in them that they want to get to know me. And then the shepherds on the mountain and stuff, very accommodating. This is not these days where you have cell phones and you take selfies and stuff, but they would want to talk to me. But again, language barrier, you could just see their smile. They want to say something, but they couldn't. So for me, the experience was such that you are welcomed here. And I never had a person in the group that was questioning my experience and such. So I was very lucky that way. And I'm glad. I always say to people, I don't think I would have climbed Everest with any other better group or team than the 2003 Everest expedition that I joined.
Amazing. It's a beautiful experience. And you had very mature people in your team, which is exciting. So every climber, Busiso, from your experience and my experience as well, has a moment where the mountain exposes their deepest fear. Whether it's somebody you know that you talked to yesterday and suddenly they become part of the mountain because they've fallen or, you know, it's real that they're not coming back. What was your lowest and most defining moment on Everest, especially your first attempt? And what inner shift kept you moving forward?
I'll not articulate it in the manner of either maybe seeing one of us lose a life on the mountain or die on the mountain. I saw some of those, and luckily in my group there was no one that succumbed to that. Mm-hmm. But in the group of 9 or 10 of us as climbers, we were the only 3 that summited, 2 with the leaders. So out of 12, only 5 of us summited. Mm-hmm. People just fell off along the way as we were going, deciding not to continue anything and other complications on summit night or anything. So in a way, we had a very smooth, safe expedition. So my moment comes when you mentioned at the beginning that it wasn't the days of mobile phones and, well, satellite telephones were sort of coming in at the time, but they were very expensive and I didn't have any money to afford that, which means that as soon as I left home, I was disconnected from my family. And family meaning my wife and 3 children. Yes, my son was about less than 2 years old. The other girls were a little bit bigger, but still young. And then I could not talk to them until I got back home, actually, to John's house where I could make a telephone call. So when I was on the mountain, I was disconnected. But one of the people in the expedition, he could afford to pay for whatever the satellite telephone would cost him a minute. And then he says to me, when we're sitting, now the mountain is raging with storms, we're sitting and he says to me, Sibusiso, how do you make contact with your family? And I said to him, no, I don't, because I can't afford the $10 a minute. I don't even have that. And then he says, but it also helps that sometimes it boosts morale and it helps if they know what you are doing. And he says, if you don't mind, I'd be happy to allow you an opportunity to make a call on my account. And then I thanked him for that. So when the day we're about to move to our final attempt on the mountain after I've been sitting down for about 10 days, I said, I would like to take your offer of calling home because I just want to say to them, we are going for what would be our last attempt on the mountain. I might come back maybe having made it, or I might come back saying it hasn't happened. Then I went through this little tent where the comms tent where they said our telephone, I said, dial up the numbers and Nomsa picks up the phone and you know your person and you can tell that she's not herself. Even though she's saying, no, we are okay. I'm like, no, this doesn't sound like her. So I start probing because I'm like, I'm at the moment where I could just decide to go home because we've had two failed attempts and the mountain is still raging with the storm. If you tell me what has happened, then it's fine. I'll be happy just to leave and come home. And then she says to me, oh, one of the nights we had one of those old-fashioned thatch houses or hut or anything where we used to make the fire and the cooking and stuff. One of the nights someone came and touched it, and we don't know why. The police have been asking us who do we suspect, and we don't know anyone. And luckily they were living in the other house, and they never went to knock or attack them or anything. So it was one of those bizarre happenings at the time. And then I said, is everyone okay? She says, yes, but everything in that little house was just bent down. We have nothing there. So I sort of composed myself after that. I've come out of that conversation. Now the mountain is raging with a storm and some storm has happened at home. So you're caught in between the two is what do you do? And I walk out of the tent. I go into my little tiny tent because at base camp, the luxury of base camp is that each climber has got their own tent. I go into my little tent and I think maybe it's time you pack your bags and you go home. Family has been attacked and you don't know what's happening. The mountain is raging with a storm. You've had an attempt and you don't know when the next move will be. At that thought of leaving, something comes into me. It says, Sibusiso, so haven't you heard experiences of attacks like that where people get killed and etc.? And I said, yes, I know it happens. It happens at home. And then the next moment was, you should be very thankful that none of your family members got injured or hurt or anything. It could be otherwise. Do yourself a favor. Walk out of here to your teammates and tell them that you are staying. You're not going to go anywhere. You're going to stay until you reach the summit because that will what can only bring a smile to the family after the tragedy that has happened. Then I walked out of the tent confidently, sore, and, hey, how did the call go? And I said, thank you very much for the opportunity. I spoke to my family. Not so good news because this is what has just happened. And then the question comes, what are you going to do? And I said, oh, no, I'm staying. I'm staying until we have another attempt on the mountain. That moment for me was the one that brought the shift in the way I thought and in the way I looked at things that happen in your life. Because that moment I realized that even if I went back home, I won't have changed the whole thing. But if I stay on the mountain, the story was going to be very different. It was just that humility, that humbling yourself to say, you know what, I know I'm not in charge. However, I'm going to stay and listen to what you are prompting me to do and see what happens. So I stayed. And as we know, I summited the mountain and we never spoke about that little house. We never spoke about the stuff we lost. We know the story is that I succeeded on Everest. So for me, there was the shift that happens. And you know what? Things will happen in your life. But if you shift your thinking, if you come to reality and be in good terms about the fact that as a human being, you are never in charge and in control, and then you live out. Second to that, though, is you come to the mountain as an African, you don't think that you will possibly be stopped by wind or blizzards from a summit. I never thought that would happen for me. We are sitting at Camp 4, and it is pre-midnight when we're about to wake up. The wind is such that the tent is collapsing on our faces, and you are thinking, surely we are not going to be called to come out of here. And sensibly, no, it doesn't happen. But in the morning, the wind subsides, and then we go towards the summit. But before summiting the mountain, another big storm. We were so close to the summit. Another big blizzard and windstorm hits us, and we almost perish. Sensibly, through leadership, again, we succeed on that. Again, I come back. And the shift for me was that, Sibusiso, as a human being, you will never be 100% in charge and in control. There will be times when outside forces or influences will determine the result of what you do. It's a question of to adapt to that and be flexible enough to work with those forces so that you can be able, maybe, if you're lucky, on another day to be able to launch your attack on the summit, because that is what happened. We had to be that flexible and that adaptable that we got the chance to go back up again. So there's a lot that I had to learn and which became a shift which happened immediately, which then got me to the top.
I love it. I think for me, what I got from your story really, so as you were narrating, first of all, it took me back to the death zone. That very, I don't know whether it's uninviting, but it's like a vicious, it's a ruthless environment to the body, to the mind. And also just realizing that there's a lot that we can't change.
Yeah.
And if we stop focusing on what we can't change, it will allow us to move into the future that we deserve.
Yes, yes. But sadly, as you will know, because we are human, I always bring that to us. I say, you know what? Because we are human beings and we've got this feeling that we are in charge. We are in control. In most cases, we think like that up until some of us like you and I are exposed to that reality, that no, then we never stop focusing on that. I think when there's a moment, I think for me, the question that we always had to ask ourselves, which then freed us, liberated us to accepting was, could we have done anything better on those two attempts, failed attempts, given our human capability? For me, that is how I probe things. You say, this is the situation. Do you, goodness, believe that with your human ability and capabilities, you could have done better? If you accept the fact that, you know what, with what I have as a human being, I did my best. And therefore, you don't focus on those things that you cannot control. Then the question becomes, what is it that you are going to do within your capability and ability to still move you forward? And then you start coming back to being a human being. I believe that when you start a race, I'm using race now, when you is into road running, when you start a race, you start with two characters. There's the ego you and the human you. The ego you will say, I'm going to run this marathon in like 3 hours and etc. That's the ego. You give it time. But that goes out the window as soon as you get to past halfway because you're looking at the time and think this is not going to happen. When you get to about 35Ks and then ego goes out the window, then you become human. Then you start strategizing and you think, okay, from this pole to that pole and to that pole, and then most important for me is just to take a finisher's medal and go away. That is when you humble yourself and become human. And that is that's very important. It's when you get to that you understand, okay, ego doesn't really help you. So when you become human, then you think logically. You realize that I'm not in control. I'm not in charge. Let me focus on the things that I can change and influence. If you can't influence the result, don't really waste your time on that one. Do the things that will help you to cut that short. In fact, most will know that I had an incident on losing a climber on a mountain here in Africa. Mm-hmm. Coming to the shift, when shift happens, you talk about losing someone. We're sitting at the summit camp and I'd given the briefing to the team and everyone looked as healthy and as happy and ready to go. But pre-midnight, we got called into one of the rooms where one of us was sick. And within a moment, the person was gone. And again, I asked the same question. Could you have done anything collectively with your team that's humanly possible to save the life? And the answer was no. The way it was orchestrated was such that there would be no human capability and ability to have done anything. And therefore accept and then just move on. And that is how I was able to come out of it.
Yeah, that is scary, but a reality in mountaineering and in life as well, because we lose people in one, you know, every day.
Exactly.
Well, every other day. But it's not because we have control over when our end comes.
No.
It's because when it comes, wherever it is that we are, it happens.
It happens. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So becoming the first Black man to summit Everest, that moment was just not a personal achievement in my mind. It was historic. It's the moment that made it possible for some of us to follow in your footsteps. What did it mean for South Africa? What did it mean for the continent in your perspective?
Looking back and knowing what I know today and how I felt, it meant a lot for Africa and for the continent. I'll put it in two parts. Before I even got home, all the media houses, there was a program that was really done by the BBC talking to other African countries where there are mountains. They spoke to Moroccans, to Kenyans and to Tanzanians. And the response was very inspiring, but much more for me. I arrived at base camp on Summited on the 26th of May, 27th we're down at Camp 2, then we went down. I arrive at base camp, it is the early morning hours of South African time, and sitting at base camp at that little comms tent is a journalist from the Sunday Times, Claire Keaton, going to write, because there was a big South African expedition at the time, and then myself with the international. So she was picking up stories, and on that morning she was just sitting waiting patiently, as you said, it wasn't those days where you were the summit of Everest, you say, oh, it's done. She was waiting patiently to find out where I was, and she knew that I'd made it through the communications over those little radios, but she wanted to see me. And she had received or taken a call from SAFM. John Perlman was talking, it was in one of those morning shows. And just before they finished, I just popped up, and then someone said, hey, there's come Sibu Sisa. And then I hear Claire saying to John, hey, John, there's Sibu. And then I got called into this little comms tent. I speak to John Perlman, and then it is live on ASM and SAFM. And John says to me, Sibu Sisa, we're very proud of you, and congratulations on climbing Everest. But much more than that, every corner in this country, everyone is talking about your achievement. So well done. And then I realized, okay, this wasn't just a story of you reaching the summit of Everest, as you articulated. Well, it was history-making, but was much more inspiring, and to the continent and to the world itself, because then people started knowing that, okay, it is true, there the people in Africa who have the same ability as everyone. So for me, that was that. In fact, one of the sort of newspaper cuttings that came up, I still have that one out, I did it for Africa. That's my belief today. And I do want to know that my story of succeeding on Everest, it's such an influence and encouragement to the many that have since followed. You are also one of those people, and well done to you, like you've done, to sort of share the same message, to say, yes, we can. So yes, looking back, I think it was profound that I did it, and the timing was right, and the continent got inspired, and we haven't stopped ever since then.
And what did it mean for you as Sibu Sisa of Ilan?
So I'll put it in this way. So we've had the two attempts on Everest, and in a way or the other, you sort of not doubt yourself, but you realize the reality is like you are you're not in control. You cannot really reach the summit as you want to. Anyway, so we get the chance to go for what would have been our final attempt. I find myself above, sort of just below the summit, and I'm on the summit reach proper. And then I start reflecting back on the journey that I traveled, how I got to Everest. And then it takes me back to that bushveld child, that little boy who grew up herding goats and cattle and with no food and no clothes to wear. And I see myself at the summit. This is before the summit. I see myself at the summit. I become overwhelmed by this thought and this feeling and that vision of me standing at the top. That how could that barefoot walker be walking on ice and on snow and about to stand and be the tallest person, if we put it that way, on the planet? It just becomes, you sort of feel like this is not real. It feels like it's something that you're dreaming about, but you are there physically. And somehow I get sort of overwhelmed by this thing and I start welling down with tears and I cry. And then the other guys, I can see them, they're standing there trying to wave at me like, come on. And I just had to compose myself.
I compose,
I'm about to reach the summit. I can't be crying. I compose myself and I take myself a deep breath, but then I sort of whisper a silent prayer saying I'm very thankful about this moment. And then I feel this sudden encouragement for me. Somehow when I think about it, it was like, this was the entire continent just lifting me up and making my steps lighter, because they've been heavy. They're so light. And then I take the last 100 meters feeling very strong and I stand at the summit. And the feeling for me was just that even if I could just collapse there and die at the top, I would have been fine with that. But you will know that people say if you die on me without coming down, some people say, no,
it's not a summit.
It doesn't count. It's not a summit. I'm glad I didn't. But the fulfillment and the meaning of that for me was such that I'm okay with it. It meant a lot that here I came from nowhere, the title of my book, by the way, to the top of Everest. I didn't know what I was saying to John when I said, yes, I would do it. But the continent meant a lot for me. So I was fulfilled. The meaning of it was huge. I don't think I can articulate it in words, what it meant to me. I still think that, I still believe that, I'm still driven by that even today. It was just that moment when it happened. It meant everything for me to reach the top. Mm.
You've taken me back, you know. I read, unlike you, before going to Everest, I read a lot that scared me and a lot that motivated me. One of the stories was the 1996 tragedy. And I remember sitting with you in 2014 on Everest, you recounting your story when coming down, your oxygen had just depleted and you found somebody that you asked for oxygen and they're like, "Bud, do you have $100? Can you tell us that story? And how, when you reflect today, what did it teach you about people's behavior at high altitude, but people's behavior in life when they don't have ubuntu, let me put it that way?
So that story was very strange or bizarre, because in all the big mountain expeditions, you go with the leader, and then you've got your teammates, and then you've got your personal climbing Sherpa. And you think that, or you believe that the leader, that's my view, the leader has all the responsibility or duty to look after all the climbers. And the Sherpa has the duty to look after his client, being me. So we had started on summit night, and we were a team of four. It was myself, another South African, and an American, and then a British. Each one of us having our own climbing Sherpa. But then obviously on summit night, you climb in different abilities, and some of them were very strong and fast. And I wasn't strong. I was climbing very well, but my climbing Sherpa had issues with his oxygen. So we sort of got disjointed or separated from the lead group, which had one of the leaders of the expeditions. But then we summited in the early morning hours of the day, and it was a great, it was one of the most beautiful summit day, clear blue skies and less wind, and you could just see as far as you can see. They waited the summit, and for me, which was very kind of them to do. Then my Sherpa and I arrive at the summit. We take the pictures, and then we start coming down. But the pre-summit night, we had been hit by a storm, where we couldn't produce enough water because it was yourself sufficient. When you get to there, you needed to make your own, as much as your Sherpas can make a little bit, but it's your responsibility. So my tent mate and I were sitting and we were trying, and the tent was falling over these little stoves when we realized we're going to just bend down our survival equipment, and we're not going to do that. So we had only managed to come up with a liter each, which we should have been drinking for the hours before the summit attempt, but we were not. So in a way, I started dehydrated already. And I started using this little water, which ran out very early. And I'm using oxygen. I get to the summit with oxygen. As I start coming down, I deteriorate because I've not been drinking enough. I haven't been eating enough. Oxygen runs out. And it's me and my climbing Sherpa coming down to the summit camp. And when I go to the summit camp, I said to him, "Can I please have some water if you guys have?" And he said, "We are going to produce some water." I start packing. And then the next I hear my teammate says, "We are leaving." And then I hear the leader say of the expedition saying, "We are leaving." And then their Sherpas are gone. My Sherpa comes through the tent. He says, "Sibusiso, have you packed? Let's go." I said, "But I asked for water. Where's the water?" I said, "No, there's no water, and we are leaving." So I thought he was going to wait for me outside. And I finish my packing and I come outside. He's no more. He's nowhere. Oof. I'm left at this camp alone, 8,300 meters, and we had to leave. And I sit down outside looking around. I realize, okay, you're on your own here. Then get down the mountain. I pick up my backpack. I can't carry it. And I decide, okay, I'm going to clip it on the rope, because the rope was still there all the way to the next camp. I'll clip it on the rope on some sections. I'll clip it on the rope and try and drag it. And then put on your crampons, because I couldn't stand. And then I realize, okay, you are done for. But at that moment, another guy comes in, and you had a client. They are checking in at the camp. I asked him, I said, after I've seen your client check in, please come and help me. And he said, okay. And then he disappears for like 10 minutes. And he comes back, he says, what help can I give? So I said to him, can you help me put on my crampons? And then I want to start climbing down. And that's what he did. Then I sort of stand and I feel like I'm okay. And I walk, I climb down, shuffling and still pushing down this little backpack of mine. And then I get to a place where I couldn't continue and I stop. As I stop, there's a group that's coming up as well, and I ask for water. The guy gives me water. He says, oh, I'm about to be at camp. He gives me water on my little water bottle. And there's something that happens at altitude. When you sit down, you feel rested. You feel like, you know, I've got all the energy back and I just drink this water. You feel like, you know, no, I'm a machine now. I'm just going to rest down to the next camp and be safe. No. How deceptive, because as soon as I took another 100 meter steps behind me, I was just depleted again to zero energy. Then it's getting too late. The sun is about to go down. Temperatures start dropping and I've run out of oxygen by the time. That's the death zone, they call it. So I'm dying in a way. And then it becomes very clear for me that, okay, Sibusiso, if you don't save your life, you're on your own, you are going to be like the other guy you've just passed. Someone had died just between Camp 3 and Camp 2. We didn't know how he has died. And then it becomes very clear that I was going to be another victim. And then if I needed to fight, and I started crawling on all fours and I dragged myself down. I couldn't roll because I didn't want to roll down, but I could. I did everything that was trying to get me to the safety of the camp. Anyway, it's a long story, but in the, just as the sun is about to go down, it has probably clicked to the people, the leader and the other people at the next camp and upper camp. They start radioing each other, Sibusiso is still not here. And then one says he should be in between the two camps because we saw him, we saw him leaving this high camp, and but if he's not at camp, he's somewhere. Now, there are two spirits of Ubuntus in the story. The first starts with a guy, Cape Town, South African, in the same team called Mark Campbell, Cape Town. Mark is sitting at Camp 4 going to for his summit attempt that night. He was with the second group, assault team. He's sitting there with his climbing Sherpa and they're about to set off. He hears the story and he says, if no one is going down to look for Sibusiso, I am going down. And then his leader says, no, no, we will send someone down. And then he says, do that now because otherwise I'm just going to go down. I have no point summiting if he's somewhere. Then they try to talk to each other as who's going down. And then Mark says, okay, let my climbing Sherpa go down anyway. And then they agree to that. So Mark, my climbing Sherpa goes down. So the point is, how did he think he was going to summit climb without his support Sherpa? Because we all need support Sherpa on that night. But he was very unselfish. And he said, okay, I'm going to give away my Sherpa to look after, to look for Sibusiso, and then I can continue climbing. And he did. So that is the first of Ubuntu spirit. His climbing Sherpa finds me after the other Sherpa was coming down from another group whom I asked. And all I asked was, can you please take the bag? Because it's the one that is really causing problem for, but I can't discard it. I've got my sleeping bag. I've got every survival kit in there and I cannot. But I need it at the next camp. Then he asked for the $100. And when I said, I don't have it with me here, but I'll give you, and they knew who we were. We were a big expedition. They were also a big expedition. And when I didn't have the cash, he said, sorry, and then he ran down. So that's when I realized at that moment that, okay, that's it. You will either die here or you save yourself. So keep fighting on. And then I fought on until I hear this voice. Now you know, you said you read. And I'd read a book called The Ghosts of Everest. Mm. And you start hearing this call and you think, is someone calling my name? And at the same time, you're thinking, maybe this is my moment.
Am I hallucinating?
It could be God already saying, come home, my son, you know. And then I stop and I look and I can't tell because he keeps quiet. Because he sees me stopping and then he thinks, okay, let me just go. He doesn't call and then I start shuffling along. I hear this call again and then eventually I look back and I see him coming down and he finds me. So he saves my life and then we get to the safety of the camp. And so, yeah, for me, that was the spirit of Ubuntu that was there and the spirit, the non-spirit of Ubuntu that existed when the other person said no. But it happens all the time because, yeah, to cut that long story short, as I was sitting at the next camp trying to clear that going down to advanced base camp, one person comes walking around the camps on a walkie-talkie, says, guys, base camp is reporting that there's a climber wearing such and such a down jacket and all of that down suit. He's died between camp 2 and camp 3. I was in camp 2, in exactly the same place where I'd almost succumbed. Does anyone know the person? And none of us claimed that. Our leader said, no, we don't. We have no person of such. Then it transpires later that the person who was radioing, calling for our teams up high to check, that was his client. He summited with the client, felt excited about the summit fever, having summited, and then he came down and passed him, left him as before camp, and raced all the way back down, having probably instructed him, get to camp 2 and rest there, then descend the next day. So he gets to base camp, he starts calling people, oh, we made it, and we're all coming down. Yet it was his client that was there. It sort of articulates, or it means that it does happen that people lose their sense of duty, particularly leaders on the mountain. Because I had a leader who lost his sense of duty. He was a summit Sherpa and leader who lost his sense of duty, and his client died, and I almost died. So it's one of those things that are very hard to take, but they are very true and they do happen. But that's, for me, I don't believe in the narrative that we mountaineers hate each other, that we don't like to help each other or save each other. We've read stories like that where people sort of sacrifice their summit to help other people. So you'll always have the two playing on the mountain. They're good, some of those that are responsible, and you can't fault them because they are surely not thinking very clearly. They don't know what is happening. Mm-hmm. So we forgive such things, painfully so, because it could have taken my life.
Absolutely. Talking about altitude, somebody said to me, we're holding the South African flag wrong. Red shouldn't be. I'm like, you don't understand. It's a wonder I remembered that I had a flag. Anyway, on that note, Sibusiso, your climbs have always been tied back to giving back, uplifting communities. Why is purpose so central to your journey, and how does it shape your definition of success today?
Thank you. It starts with a kind gesture by a wonderful Canadian couple that I worked for as a guardian boy when I was at secondary school. And one day I shared with them that my stepdad, who was a security guard, was almost not going to be able to pay for my next school fees. I might be dropping out of school and going to look for work. And Douglas and Penny then sat down and said, we have accepted to support you, or decided to support you together with our small children until you get your matric. And after that, we will not be able to afford, because our children's school needs will be higher, but that is what we're going to afford you. So they allow me this opportunity to sit in school. That gives me the basic education that I would have to take and use to change my life. And that generosity or kindness didn't cost me anything. It just cost me to work well and do my best, because they didn't say you will have to pay us back. So it started that interest for me to be able to support others. Then it comes to John as well. John did the same thing. Coming in financial support by John, I think he did everything apart from his mutual and support. He put in a lot of financial resources to help me achieve what he had left me having achieved. And again, he never said, well, some of it will have to pay me, or it will cost you so much. And so that instilled. But it was realizing that there are people that came into my life who didn't even know who I was, who had no reason to look after me and care for me and give me opportunity, but they did. And when they did, they never said it will cost you that much. So it sort of gave me the wish to one day support someone, particularly in education, because I valued what they had given me as into basic education, because I realized that was what I needed and to change my life. So I said, if every child could have an opportunity to sit in school and finish their high school, that's okay. From there on, it's up for them to decide what they want to do, whether college or anything, but it was that. And then I had a comment by one of the lady or female climbers in my group in 2000, a Canadian, who said, "Oh, it's a personal ambition to climb Everest, but much more than that, I'm doing it for charity." So I said to her, how do you climb a mountain for charity? And she explained to me that you put your name up there and tell people that this is what you are doing, and others will contribute or donate, but much more is raising awareness about a cause that is closest to your heart. And I thought, I would have done it like that as well, just to educate a child, in appreciation of the people that came into my life to help me. But anyway, it's okay, because I can't do it now. So that planted the seed that motivation is much more stronger when you are doing it not for yourself, but for the benefit of someone. It can be just one person. So I decided to go to Everest. I wasn't too excited about climbing Everest again. I had spoken to Ronald Fiennes, who had sent me a card saying, "Congratulations on your achievement. It is quite remarkable." But having sat with him and listened to him, I realized that Everest was missing from his adventure. So I said to him, "Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. However, if you decide one day to climb Everest, I would like us to do it together, and I want us to do it for charity." And to my absolute delight and surprise, I got a telephone call from him saying, "Oh, thank you very much for inviting me for this Everest. I don't know where we can start. How do you go about it? Because I'd like us to do it." It was 2004. So I said to him, "Look, there's a company in your country, in Sheffield. This is their name and contact. If you reach out to them, and I'm sure they'll be able to sort of tell you what to do." And you went and followed up with them. And then Jagat Globe said, "Okay, we will be happy to put an expedition together." But I dictated that if we go on the north side. And Ronald Fiennes said, "I don't mind which other side we go." Because I said, I have no reason to go to Everest again and do the same route. So I said, north side, and we do it for charity. And then after that, I realized it is possible and it is motivating and inspiring to do something that is bigger than you, because it gives you meaning, which is the purpose and your fulfillment. I was very fulfilled when we came back and we signed the three checks that went to the three children organizations that could benefit from that. And I said, there's no way I could have signed a check from whatever my earnings or anything, but through my physical effort and putting myself in that space to benefit someone else, I was able to do that. So that is what has inspired the way I do things today. It is just correct and just right for me. I cannot see myself doing it for nothing. It has to be for a reason, and that reason has to do with empowering someone or gifting someone an opportunity that they never thought possible.
Amazing. So people see the flag on the summit, and they are not privy to the internal ascent that it takes to get there. What routines, rituals, or beliefs, at least three, that keep you grounded through fear, uncertainty, isolation sometimes, as based on your story, and how do they support you now?
Yeah, so it's a tough one, that one. It's hard to articulate, but I maybe very quickly, let me use another line from Penny Watt, the person that helped me. When I wrote to them and I said, "I'm going to climb Everest," and she wrote back saying to me, "Well, we never thought when we gave you the opportunity, when that young man who walked into our yard, that we're going to grow up and be this man that you've become. And no one thing," this was his, "no one thing, the mountain that is you're about to climb was put up there by the Creator, the Almighty, who called him God and whatever. And he will be able to equip you with what you will need to climb this mountain." And then that for me was, humble yourself, be spiritually connected to it, be religiously connected to it, meaning understand that there's someone who's bigger than what is happening around you that is capable of giving you that ability. So I had that spiritual connection. I am religious, and I carried, in fact, to end that story, then in that little, was through a letter, in that little envelope, she had put the New Testament. And I thought, I'm going to take that and probably read it. So I was spiritually connected with my who I am and knowing that there is someone who's bigger than me who can just give me what I need. And I would just read my scriptures and pray and hope that it will happen. So I was influenced by that. But again, coming from my background, it was knowing that, you know, you come from a background where what you are doing is unknown and you don't know what you are doing, but humble yourself and learn from the other people in front of you. It was just the humility that I brought to the mountain that made me to be able to leave. But at the same time, it was when we couldn't go to the summit that I sat and this the idea that I was going to climb this mountain was about to go out the window because I wasn't losing the self-belief. The self-belief was still there, but I was losing the sort of hope on the weather part. But when we were given the chance to go for the final attempt, I realized that the one thing I had within me was just being able to never lose hope that the mountain will give us a chance. So for me, those are the three. It was just my spiritual connection and that humility of learning as you go and never losing that hope that kept me going. And that is what I still live by today. I never lose hope. It doesn't matter how many times I fail. But I cannot afford to lose the hope that one day, if I still live, I will be able to continue and achieve.
Absolutely. That's why I love the thing that I always say, keep stepping.
Yes.
Keep putting a foot after the other. You know, like all good things, things come to an end. And I have one last signature question. And it is really about, because we know that shift happens, things happen all the time. It evolves. It's the only constant. When shift happened in your life as Sibusiso Vilani, what did it teach you about who you are and who you are becoming?
When the shift happened to me, because coming from the background I come from, in fact, I didn't share that. I think I grew up in an environment where you were never given a tap on the shoulder to say, well done, except my mother who said one day you will grow up. But everything around you was just forcing you to believe that you are worth nothing, you are nothing. And so when this shift happened for me, it just made me realize that actually it is not really about your background. It's not about your upbringing. It's not about the environment where you live. The one core thing is about how ambitious you want to be and how far you want to go and how high you want to go, and that only yourself can stop you from achieving. It can never be any person. It can never be any of the environment that you're living in. It is just only you that can hold you. And once I acknowledged and realized that, then I realized that I was as capable as anyone. And it was just going to take me hard work and the effort. And there will be storms along the journey. It can never be easy. It will always be uphill, as I want to believe. And there will be the twists and turns. But if you hold on to what you believe in and fight for that, you will always succeed. So for me, that is what happened. It just taught me that, Sibusiso, you are capable. But much more, when the shift happens, I think I say to people, for me, it was more of a... The shift to me was much more of an enlightenment, if I can use that word. Mm. I became very enlightened that every human being is so capable to achieve such that they will never know how far and how high they can go. We can lie to ourselves that I know my limitations. I beg to say
differ.
No. I beg to say no. It's okay if you believe that's what it is, but if we go deep down, you don't really know. So the question becomes, why do you want to limit yourself? And that's why I sort of say in my little hashtag thing, I am inspiring a generation of people who know no limits, because there are no limits. And it only happened when that shift in the way I look at myself, in the way I think, and in the way things have happened, that actually we all are limitless.
amazing, a limitless generation. That's what we are aspiring to have for Africa and the world as a whole. What an amazing and inspirational talk that we've had today with you. So what I've taken out, really, your journey reminds us that greatness is not reserved for the chosen. It is built by those who choose courage over certainty, possibility, over limitation, and purpose over comfort. And to you, the listeners, the shift has happened. And the question is no longer, what happened? It's really, who will I become because of it? Don't shrink your dreams to match your fears or the environment that you grew up in or what your neighbors said about you. Don't wait for permission to rise. Take the step. Own the climb. Honor your purpose. So, Sibisiso, thank you. Thank you for sharing your insights, your time, and amazing to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you would like to explore some of the lessons and tools we spoke about today, you'll find them in the show notes. If today's conversation spoke to you, share it with someone that's facing their own climb. Together, we are rising, one shift at a time. When Shift Happens is a Jackpod original podcast by Jacaranda FM. Let's go higher.